You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet a member of a talented new generation of Oklahoma writers. Brandon Hobson teaches at Northern Oklahoma College and is the author of three previous acclaimed small press novels. His 2014 novella, Deep Ellum, was listed on Reader's Digest's Best Short Books Under 150 Pages, and he's a 2016 winner of the Pushcart Prize, a top prize for writers from small press publishers. His latest book, Where the Dead Sit Talking, published by Soho Press, is a dark coming-of-age story set in rural Oklahoma in the late 1980s. In it, we meet 15-year-old Sequoia, now in the foster home system, a system he seems to be familiar with. His single mother is in jail for crimes related to her drinking and self-medicating. Cut off from his Cherokee heritage, only remembered through traces of conversations with his grandfather, Sequoia keeps his conflicted and churning emotions to himself. But at this new rural foster home, he meets 17-year-old Rosemary, also an Indian, and someone he has a shared connection to. She has her own secrets and difficulties. Hobson is a Cherokee himself and a former social worker, and his book brings these hurt and hurting characters to life. The name of the new book is Where the Dead Sit Talking. It's published by Soho Press. Brandon Hobson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This has been a nice series of books and novels that have been coming out over the last few years. And Where the Dead Sit Talking, it's really an arresting story. What was the origin of this story about this young boy who's in foster care, Sequoia?
Well, it started really with an image. And I had an image of a youth, Native American youth, who was in foster care and was going through some identity problems, which I think a lot of youth go through, 15 years old, trying to figure out who he is, who his family is, how his Native American identity plays a role, because he's not full Cherokee. He's part Cherokee. So there's that going on. And then there's also some issues with his idea of what he wants to be, right? And so I had this character and this youthful voice in my mind, and I was wanting to really try to get that on the page, because youthful voices have been, in novels, a big influence on me. And I think about characters like Scout from To Kill a Mockingbird, Holden Caulfield from Catcher in the Rye. And what may be a little bit of an influence on this book is the voice of Jeffrey Cartwright in Stephen Milhauser's really dark novel, Edwin Mulhouse. And so there are these dark, youthful voices that I wanted to try to convey through Sequoia.
You mentioned Sequoia is at that time of life, 15, where he really doesn't know what he's going to do with his life. He also had a pretty traumatic childhood. You mentioned the Native American heritage. It's obviously important to him because in the first pages of the narration, he tells you how important knowing about that heritage is. His great-grandfather would tell him stories, and those are the stories that stuck with him. But he's really disconnected from that heritage for the most part, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. He is disconnected. And, you know, again, that's part of what compelled me when I think about teenagers. And I did social work for a little while. So I worked with teenagers, and so many of them were just completely lost in understanding who they are, right, or who they were. And so that the Native American identity is part of it. But there's also there's some gender questions, I think, that Sequoia is. He's very, very interested in Rosemary, not, as he tells us, he's not attracted to her, but at times he wants to become her. He wants to be her. He wants to dress like her. He wants to look like her. So there's some sort of gender issues as well going on with him.
At his first day of school at his new foster home, which is in rural Oklahoma, he's been in around the Tulsa area with his mother, but his mother's now in prison. She's had issues with alcohol and substance abuse, and now she's in prison. He's been in a shelter. He's found a foster home now. And the first day at school, when he goes into the bathroom, the first thing he does is put eyeliner on. in a rural Oklahoma school. Mm-hmm. I assume you grew up in Oklahoma too. Mm-hmm. That's sort of an interesting first day thing. It obviously points out this idea that he's not real sure who he is.
Right. And again, that idea of identity, I think even though, yes, we're in Oklahoma and it's a rural school, I still have an idea that it's large enough that it's not too odd. I think that there are a lot of sort of gender questions going on out there, and that's become more acceptable now than it was in 1989, which is when this
book is set. Book yeah, that's, set. What, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, just the with time. The time period. But yes, and you know, it all comes down to who is he? And that's a common question that, again, I think teenage girls probably are a little better maybe about understanding who they are more than boys are.
And I think one of the things about boys of that age, Sequoia is the type of boy that if you ask him, how was school? He says, fine. How are you doing? What's up with you? Okay. And that's about all you're going to get from him. But what you do with the book is you obviously give us this fertile inner dialogue that's fertile for all boys of that age when they say, I'm fine, I'm okay, nothing. Yeah. You know, those are the verbal replies, but what's going on inside is much more fertile. And I assume that's the place where you really mine the character.
That anger, confusion, his father has left. And it's just been his mother. He's been from place to place. And he tells us early in the book, he describes rooms that he's, different foster homes he's been in. You know, and I was also thinking about much like the way that the Cherokees were pushed out of their land and really not sure where they were going back in the 1800s, which is a big part of Oklahoma history. And we're a tribal state. There are a lot of tribes in Oklahoma, and there are a lot of Native American youth out there. And I really was interested in having a voice for a really different type of youthful character here. There just aren't a whole lot of Native American youthful voices in literary fiction right now, it seems to me.
Tell us about exploring this character and exploring his circumstances.
Well, I became interested, again, in the idea that here's someone who is going to be moved from place to place, from home to home, and really is struggling with trying to find what is home, what is family. My dad has left. My mom is locked up. I have a foster family here. They don't want me. I'm in the shelter. I get moved out of there. I have another foster family. What is family? What am I? What are siblings? What are we? How are we supposed to interact with each other? Those are very, very difficult questions to deal with, and especially for a teenager.
You know, there's a dialogue with his caseworker, Liz, mm-hmm. that appears from time to time in this relationship. He actually has a foster family that actually seems to really care for him as a person. The foster father actually understands a little bit of where Sequoia is coming from himself, and he actually shares quite mm-hmm. a bit of his own personal history. He is a bookie. His father was a bootlegger bookie. And met an untimely, horrible end that he witnessed. His murder.
Right.
Yet, you know, this caseworker comes in, and we know that Sequoia cares deeply for his mother. At the very beginning of the book, he talks about all the times he has helped her, you know, when she's recovering from being drunk or and you know, hurtful boyfriends and the like. And yet here's this caseworker that keeps coming back and says, okay, your mother has a probation hearing. I think mm-hmm. she's going to get out. She mm-hmm. doesn't get out. It's just sort of almost like this tug between trying to find a place where you are and this other world that's sort of out there that it's sort of dangling, you know, it's like the yarn for a kitten, you know,
yeah.
just keep moving the yarn right outside of the kitten's grasp.
Well, and with the foster family. I think so many foster families get bad raps, right? That they, mm-hmm. we only hear about bad foster families. We don't hear about the good foster families. Part of what I was really interested with this foster family was the dad being a bookie, sort of underneath, you know, sort of under the covers being a bookie, that is that really, you know, how great of a guy is he? He is very nice, right? And he's very honest with, or at least we think he's honest with Sequoia, saying, here's what I've gone through with my own father and his problem, right? And here's what I learned. You know, meanwhile, he's kind of, you know, down in the basement and he's making calls and he's booking bets. So we, you know, we're not really sure. And part of my reason for exploring that is, again, the mask of identity. Are we who we say we are? And that sort of adds to a little bit, I think, for Sequoia, that whole idea of, am I who I say I am? Or am I putting up a front? Because I think the dad, part of it is, you know, the very, at least want to appear to be conservative Christians, but we're not sure that they really are, because conservative Christians may not be interested in, you know, I'm taking illegal money from
having a cocktail before dinner.
And having a cocktail before dinner, right? So, you know, the mask of who is this person really is a big part of what I'm interested in.
I assume that that also goes for the other characters that we meet when he comes to this household. He meets Rosemary, mm-hmm. also Native American. She's Kiowa, mm-hmm. little older, and seemingly, at least at first glance, maybe a little more in touch with her Native American heritage. Mm-hmm. And George is his roommate, which is very interesting character. Mm-hmm. He's obviously, I don't say he's autistic, but he's certainly on the spectrum somewhere, mm-hmm. and he has that bluntness.
Yeah.
Of letting you know where he is. When he deigns to talk, he likes to write more than he likes to speak. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So tell us about these characters.
George is, on the spectrum, which Sequoia right away picks up on. He may be autistic or something. And I think in 1989, of course, that was before kids were really being sort of labeled autistic. Not many as there are now. But George certainly becomes a sort of friend to Sequoia because they share a room together. And also, George is one of the few people in the novel who will just sort of say what he feels and even do what he feels. And there's a point in the book where he gets into bed with Sequoia, not in any kind of strange, weird way, but more as a sort of little brother way, or at least that's how I wanted it to be. Sequoia's not really sure how to react to that because it's so sort of abrupt and in the middle of the night.
Yeah, but you can also see that George warms to Sequoia because Sequoia shows empathy from him in the very start, which probably has not been George's lot in life.
He does, yes. And at the same time, and I want to point this out, not to make Sequoia too angelic, because he does have some really dark feelings and thoughts and borderline dangerous thoughts. And I was really interested in writing a really dark book here that by the end we're left questioning. This isn't just we're not really sure how sweet Sequoia really is. And does he really have all these dark thoughts that he's telling us?
But one of the things you do in the book is you unleash those very slowly.
Yes.
That was purposeful on your part?
Yes. I try to make it very subtle. Mm-hmm. Very subtle.
There's one moment where he's putting on eyeliner in the bathroom, and I think some kid makes a crack, and he's ready to fight at a moment's notice.
Sure.
But that doesn't occur. But then he spits on the mirror. Mm-hmm. Just sort of rubs it in the mirror and leaves. And it's like this is one of the first sort of signs you get that, okay, there's something different. You know, there is this dangerous side of him.
Yes.
Or antisocial side, very antisocial side.
The bathroom seems to be that room where kids at schools can go to sort of vent their frustrations. Or at least that's my memory of being in school where kids would, you know, all the anxiety of schools, they would go in there and write on the walls or punch the walls or spit or, you know, all sort of disgusting things. So that was part of it. It's also the room where the teacher, one of the teachers sort of,
that's right,
sort of is. And there are a couple of scenes where there's a teacher, Mr. Gillis, who is hanging out in the men's restroom. And sort of draws Sequoia with a couple of questions, odd questions, you know. And that's a subtle way, I think, of, you know, why is the teacher hanging out in the room? That sounds very strange. But
he's a character device, isn't he?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, sort of get us, help us understand Sequoia a little better.
A little, yes, a little bit. And then, of course, going over and seeing a drawing with a stick figure holding a gun, for example, on the bathroom wall, right? And mm-hmm. all these sort of clues that take place in the bathroom at the high school, right?
My guest today is Brandon Hobson, a remarkable writer. He's a 2016 recipient of the Pushcart Prize. His latest book is titled Where the Dead Sit Talking. It's published by Soho Press. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you haven't talked a whole lot about Rosemary. Rosemary is this kind of a catalyst character, isn't she?
She is. She's at the beginning of the book. Sequoia's not really sure how to take Rosemary because she's very evasive, and she becomes what I think is the object of the book for Sequoia, the person he's most interested in. Again, not in any strange way, in a way where that I'm not sure that he understands yet. And it becomes a very dangerous type of obsession where when she's gone with a friend, he sneaks into her room and goes through her closet and looks through her clothes, and then he goes through her dresser, and he even tells us, I'm not sure what I was looking for, right? But he was looking for clues for something. And I hope that with that scene, that's really him digging for himself as well. He does tell us that he sees so much in himself, in Rosemary, and that in a way he wants to be her, he wants to look like her, he wants to dress like her. And in fact, he even tries on an article of her clothing during that scene. And so she is a very, very important part of this book to help us understand Sequoia.
Yeah. And one of the things I kept, as I was going through the book and reading it, is that from their first meeting, you realize all three of these kids that are in this foster home are, they've got damage, you know, in certain mm-hmm. ways. There's a reason why they're in foster care. And it's evident from the very beginning. But as you go through with these kids, you have to remind yourself of that. Because, and then you ever so often, you remind us very, very specifically that these are damaged kids trying to figure out their own way.
They're damaged, and we live in a world with damaged kids all around us. And, you know, just the other day, there was a horrible school shooting, and that is the world we live in. And generally, it's, you know, younger kids, and there's a mental health issue going on with Sequoia. And I think there are a lot of young kids who are having mental health issues out there. I'm not saying that they're all going to do horrible things, but that's part of Sequoia's character. It's part of Rosemary's character because she's attempted suicide many times, but I think she tells us a couple of times. George isn't necessarily a danger to himself, but he's been ignored, as he tells us. A letter from his grandparents. He shows Sequoia a letter from his grandparents where all they're talking about is the food they ate on their Las Vegas vacation.
That's right. He says, do they write you often? He goes, no, about 3 years ago they wrote from Miami or something.
Right, right.
He's also talking about the food.
Talking about what they had for dinner, right? Rather than asking
any meaningful questions.
Any meaningful questions. And so that becomes something that I'm very interested in. And still today, and I've been thinking about that a long time. I was in social work for a little while, and I saw a lot of kids that had mental health issues. And so as Sequoia having this, not only this very nice, sweet side, I think it's also important to note that he has issues and he needs help.
Was that part of the, you know, your experience in social work? Was that one of the things that drew you down this path toward telling this particular story?
Yes, that was a lot of it because I was around so many. I was in social work for 7 years before I did a PhD, and mm-hmm. I mean, at some point it just became too depressing for me. And I wasn't around, you know, I wanted to be in a writing program and I ultimately wanted to teach, but I did social work and mainly worked with youth, both delinquent and deprived youth. And so I saw a lot of it. And so I know there's a lot of them out there that don't come from good homes. And it seems like so many teenage protagonists or coming of age novels will be kids coming from good homes, right? And so I wanted to sort of, you know, show here's a different side to it.
If I can talk a little bit just about how the novel's being received, I'm wondering, did you sense this is a young adult novel or it was just a novel? Because what I'm hearing from reviews is people are saying, well, I thought this was going to be a young adult novel, but this is a novel. What was your thought process, or were you just trying to tell a good story?
Well, I'm always trying to tell a good story, but in no way is this a young adult novel, and I hope that people don't come to the book thinking that because
there have been reviews that have talked about that.
Yeah, and I don't know why. I don't understand why. Unless, you know, my publisher, Soho, did say coming of age, that may draw people to think,
yeah,
right, that it's for, you know, young adults. And I think certainly a teenager would be fine. There are some very dark things in this book, and I hope that people will be able to see that and appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, you're telling a story that unfortunately all too often exists in a lot of communities.
Absolutely.
Our community, every community in this country.
Of
these kids that are damaged, they don't get help that they need. They're often left too often to their own prescribing, their own therapy to figure out what's happened in their life and how do they make a better go of it in the future.
I hope that it's a novel of hope.
Yeah.
At some level. But that being said, they're, as you say, it's they're very damaged.
We know Sequoia survives what ultimately happens in this as he's relating this at the very beginning of the book, but you're right.
Mm-hmm. And he tells from the very beginning, it opens with him now in present day saying, here's what happened many years ago.
I was looking back at you received the Pushcart Prize a couple of years ago and for the story Past the Econolodge, and I was having already taken a look at the book. I was reading the story and I'm going, wait a minute, I've read this before. and you actually took this and put it in the book. What was it about that particular story that you wanted to get into this novel?
That voice, Sequoia, was there, and I had written parts of the book back then.
Was it, were they set as standalone stories, or did it become a novel later? Or was
it became a novel later. There were different stories, all from the same voice, and I knew it was Sequoia's voice, and I had him in a few different situations here. And in fact, there may be a couple of stories that aren't even in the book that are from Sequoia's voice. And I publish in a journal called Noon, which is an annual. And they're the ones who nominated for the Pushcart that ultimately won. And the editor, Diane Williams, there has always really encouraged me, especially with those stories, to really push the boundaries, to really, you know, she sent edits and said, why don't you push this even more, right? So so his voice is very much on edge.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So as this novel was taking shape, this character came well before you knew you had a novel out of it, right? And it was just these stories you're writing. And at what point did you say these stories can be a novel?
I think early on, because Sequoia's voice was so strong in my head with these stories. I think early on I had an idea. I've always been interested in a strong, youthful voice as a narrator in literary fiction. So I think I knew early on, and it really just kind of fell together. It fell together very nicely, and I think once you have a voice like that established, it sort of tells itself. And I think it's maybe a little bit like acting. When someone gets into character, that's That's how I see writing is, you know, we spend large amounts of our time inside the head of characters and write about them, which is probably what actors do when they're taking on a role. And when you spend that much time thinking about this is how this person would react to this, right? At some point, it becomes easy to be able to write a scene because you know exactly how they're going to react, how they're going to, say something and what they're going to do.
As you read the book, you unfold the darkness that you're talking about, but this inner voice that's been a part of you has been pretty dark for a while. What do you do after the book like this comes out? And, you know, you obviously set that character aside, but do you look for something completely different as a writer or what exactly for you?
Are you asking me what I'm working on next?
Well, that's what I'm getting at. But, right. But I'm just saying, you know, what, after you spending so much time with this dark character, you know,
it's kind of sad. If I mean, because I don't expect to ever spend time with Sequoia or George or Rosemary again. Yeah. You know, so yeah, it is. It's kind of sad after you spend a long time writing about them. But the thing about writing is it should be, David Foster Wallace said it should be fun. And I've always believed very much in that. Finding new characters and new situations and working on that is always exciting as a writer. So I am working on something new and it's very exciting. And
Is it very different from what you've just been working on or do you try to sort of find a connective point between this book and whatever the next project is?
Well, the project I'm working on now does have to do with the Trail of Tears, mm-hmm. But told in a very strange way. So, you know, it's still very early in the draft, but that is part of what I'm working on now is sort of historical novel about the Trail of Tears, a two narrator story, one present day, one in the past.
Yeah. All right. Well, Brandon, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Oklahoma writer Brandon Hobson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled Where the Dead Sit Talking. It's published by Soho Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Rigsby at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.